Hi, this is Eve Fairbanks. I'm of the New Republic and here with Rob Farley of the Patterson School at the University of Kentucky, I believe. I hope that's right.
Yep.
Hi, Rob.
Yep. Hey, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm very well. I'm very well.
So we are about to go on warp speed. We're taping this on Sunday night and about to kick off into a crazy few weeks leading up to Obama's inauguration, stimulus negotiations and the showdown in the Senate with Roland Burris and all this stuff kind of culminating in Obama's grand inaugural moment. And I wanted to just start off talking a little bit about the inauguration and what kind of tone it ought to strike. I noticed, so there's a whole lot of kind of concern about tone and the tone that the Democrats offer and the tone of Harry Reid towards Roland Burris and the tone that Obama strikes in his first meetings with Congress, which I guess are happening tomorrow, and then also with the inauguration itself, and a lot of concern that it be exactly right. You know, this is sort of like a huge historical moment that's kind of seems to call for a lot of exhilaration. On the other hand, you have the deepening economic crisis, and there is this idea out there that I've heard a lot that the tone of the inauguration should be almost like wartime, more somber, so, you know, scaled down parties, and I wonder how that affects the inaugural speech itself. Obviously, Obama's, you know, we're not going to hear about it till it happens. He and John Favreau are holed up and just gonna kind of show us whatever they've got on the 20th, but I wanted to start off and ask what kind of, say you had a fantasy Obama inauguration speech, what kind of tone you think, and I'll just say real quick, I mean, there is this sense that there ought to be like a sobriety to the moment and a sense of the great weight upon his shoulders and the kind of huge, you know, the huge burden of all the screwed up things that he's receiving to take care of, the economy, what's going on in the Middle East, you know, things can seem dark, but I wouldn't want it to seem too somber. I thought his speech on Victory Night on November 4th was to me too kind of gloomy and sort of his jaws were too set, and I kind of want to see him strike a broader theme of kind of, you know, maybe himself and how his own story, or if he can find some other story, still shows just the tremendous vitality of the nation and its capacity for rebirth and some of this kind of a little bit more rousing, as opposed to, it would really be grim, I think, if he got into this kind of a John Edwards vein of, and I met so many people during the campaign who were suffering, and there's so much suffering, and the country's, you know, in deep crap. So,
but I
don't know. Are you more for the sober?
Yeah, you know, I guess in things like this, I prefer brevity. So, you know, I want him to deal with all of those things, and I want him to be sober and happy, and, you know, I mean, sort of the comparison with the Victory Night speech is really interesting, right? Because the Victory Night speech, it's about two things, but it's more about thanking your supporters than it is about making the case to the people who didn't support you.
Right.
And I think the inauguration is obviously going to be, you know, it's going to have the same mix of that. But I think it has to, and I, you know, that's why Rick Warren's going to be there. It has to be a little bit leaning on the other side, right? Making claims, or making arguments, to the people who didn't necessarily elect you, but, you know, arguing or making clear that you are their president too, and you understand that yourself to be their president, too.
Yeah, I thought he did that during the Victory Night speech, actually. I remember he said, you know, to all of those who didn't support me, I hope that I can, I forget the exact language, but I hope that I can be a successful president for you too, or that your minds are going to be open, or, you know, he made some kind of, what I thought was a nice gesture. Right. It was more the, and I had a, you know, there was sort of argument over this, and I think I was on the minority side here, but he had this kind of, you know, he didn't crack a smile once, or sort of, there was no elation. I guess maybe
well,
it
seemed
like
he didn't
gloating.
Have that nice, he had that nice, what was it he opened with? Hello Chicago? And it felt like a rock band or
like
sorry. Yo, you know?
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Hello Detroit, oh wait,
yeah.
Chicago.
Well, what is the case that he could make? I mean, you know, my plug-in to the conservative world is somewhat limited, but not as limited as it could be. My whole family is quite conservative, and I have friends along that line, and they're just very, you know, they take a certain pleasure in not being touched by the Obama magic. So I think it's hard for him because on the one hand, if he offers some really stirring, very kind of rhetorical speech, you feel that's kind of what he can deliver, because that's the kind of thing that he's known for at his best. On the other hand, then that kind of, you know, there's a pleasure that some conservatives take in being immune to that. Saying,
right. And sort of being serious, right? That serious people aren't. And, you know, it's not just conservatives. I mean, I think that there were other claims made along those lines, especially during the primaries.
Right.
People arguing about sort of his rhetorical style. But, it, you know, it is an interesting thing because obviously his rhetorical style is one of his strengths. And certainly, I mean, he understands that, you know, there were three huge speeches he was going to make in this campaign, and there was, you know, well, beyond the ones he sort of incidentally had to make. But the accepting the nomination, the victory night speech, and then this speech, right? I mean, he's going to have State of Union addresses, you know, down the road and so forth. But this is going to be more viewed than any of those, right? It's going to be taken more seriously. So, yeah, I mean, it is, you know, it is really interesting to think about which way he's going to go. I mean, I guess my guess would be that sort of the historical uniqueness of his victory is so well understood already that he's not going to feel the need to remind people of that. And so my guess is that he's actually just going to try to bring people down a little bit, not down into you know, mass suicides across Washington D.C. or anything like that, but to sort of tone that down because, you know, he understands it's a strength, but he also understands that that he's, you know, he's no longer a presidential candidate. He's the president. So, I mean, you're in D.C., right? I mean, so are you going to it, or am I wrong about that?
I am D.C., and I hope I'm going to it. Press credentials are, you know, they have 10 times the number that that were requested for poor Bush's second inaugural in 2004, and 10 times the requests and the same number of credentials to hand out. So we'll all see. We're all kind of in the breadline for our meager allotment of credentials. But,
right.
You know, I'll be on the mall if I'm not up in the press stand. So bring people down. I don't know. I mean, I think you're right that this is a moment for him, a little bit like the 04 convention. I mean, he made it. He's president now. He doesn't, to my mind, he doesn't have to worry as much about, you know, dampening the messianic kind of ridicule that was hitting him during the primary. There was all this sense that, oh, that was going to be the downfall of him and people were going to get a load of his supporters and how cultish or whatever they were and run screaming in the other direction. And obviously he withstood that problem, and there's something very real about his appeal. His approval ratings are like the highest, 75% approval.
Something like that. Approval.
Something,
yeah. Approval.
Crazy, you know?
Right. In what has been a very difficult interregnum period, right? And you know, just sort of on a personal note, I find it almost crazy how long ago November 4th seems right now. It feels like
That's
it was
true.
Like 2 years ago, something along those lines. And I can't believe George Bush is still president. You know, and I guess I do harbor hostility towards the guy, but, you know, it's just, you know, I wake up in the morning and George Bush is still president, and it's like, whoa, it really is a long time between Election Day and Inauguration Day.
Yeah, his lame duck. Maybe everyone's is like this to some extent, but it's just been so weird. My mother, amazingly, is on the White House Christmas card list. Mm-hmm. I think because of all her donations to the RNC or whatever now. It's auto-signed, so it's not like she got a handprint with a lipstick kiss print from Laura herself or whatever. But she's on like the B-tier Christmas card list, and it's this kind of amazing image of a like the view out from the White House, I think it is, towards the Washington Monument, towards one of the major D.C. buildings, and the sun is setting, and there's like somebody walking off into the distance, and it's very kind of elegiac and weird, but. Mm-hmm.
Right. So, I mean, do you think, you opened your statement with the, you know, question about tone. I mean, do you think this stuff matters? Do you think that, the tone that he establishes early on, is this really going to make a difference? Or can he make a serious mistake at this point in terms of the goals of his administration, by setting the wrong tone in Washington, or can he do really well by setting the right tone? I'm a political scientist.
There has been so much obsession over tone. I think there was this Washington Post piece today, and it was talking a little bit more about how his administration is going to try to impact the tone on Capitol Hill, which is obviously very bitter and negative and not being helped by some of this Roland Burris stuff and now Franken continuing, you know, fight to the death, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know. I mean, the question is how much he can kind of himself alter the way people behave up on the Hill just by the kind of inspiration of his presence. And I don't mean that to sound all goo goo gaga, but I think that can be a factor. I mean, I would think of two things, you know. On the one hand, I think of the Henry Waxman energy fight, that Waxman pitched with Dingell over the control of the energy panel in the House. And that seems like a bit of a random segue for me to bring up. But, you know, I remember thinking and talking with people in my office that the Blue Dogs, those are the very conservative Democrats, were all going to probably, or our energy guy who writes for us particularly thought that they would all go for Dingell because he's more kind of, seems like a more natural ally policy-wise. And it was a somewhat of a surprise. I remember I was there standing kind of staking out the outside of the room where they were all voting on that. And it was a surprise when word emerged that Waxman had won. And I think, you know, the ballot is secret, but, one of the Blue Dogs, a new guy named Frank Cradiville from Eastern Maryland, an interesting guy, came out. I did a story on him. I know him a little bit and we were talking and he said, he thought the Blue Dogs were really split, and there was this sensation like they wanted, you know, they were inspired by Obama and the Obama election, and they wanted change. They wanted to get onto this like more kind of progressive, get things done kind of change bandwagon. And they saw Henry Waxman as, while he's not remotely a conciliator, he is in a certain way in the Obama mold, and that he's this legislator, you know, some of the Clean Air Act, some of these huge things, that the kind of legislation that Congress doesn't pass anymore, these kind of, where government's really doing something, or, you know, to solve these problems or whatever, that he was a representative of that. So a lot of them obviously backed him. And I think, you know, the very sort of existence of Obama facilitated that to some degree. I don't know to what extent what Obama does, he kind of is what he is, and he's so consistent, you know, so it's hard for me to see him tonally, he's so unflappable, tonally screwing up. I mean, it's also, he does have very high expectations, though, and I wonder what you think of that.
Well, you know, I mean, I think it's such an interesting, and, you know, talking a little bit about the interregnum, it feels like the most disastrous interregnum since You know, I was thinking about the other day, and so, you know, what
you
other
mean
stuff
with,
has
like,
happened?
Blagojevich.
Right. Well, you know, not just Blagojevich, but suddenly there's a war, and the economy continues to collapse at, you know, full speed. You know, Afghanistan, a whole bunch of stuff. And I was thinking back to really how many other disasters have happened. You know, you can't really say that, you know, Blagojevich is a disaster that happened before November 4th, right, you know, in a sense, but it really came out after November 4th. I was trying to think back what are the worst things that have happened between November 4th or between the election and the inauguration in terms of giving the president a real sense of crisis when he comes into power. There was the 1992 with Somalia, with President Bush authorizing the use or the deployment of troops to Somalia, which sort of created problems for the Clinton administration. Which, you know, sort of people darkly hinted back then that was the intent, was to create problems for the Clinton administration. But really nothing like this. You know, and sort of thinking back to 1980, too, or 80 as well, and you have stagflation, and you have the hostage crisis, and the Russian invasion of Afghanistan. All those were sort of things that had developed before the election and that led to Carter's defeat. But at the same time, you know, they aren't stuff, I mean, I guess they're sort of like the stuff that's happened in the last 3 months here.
Right, and yet it's very odd that, you know, people are very happy with.
Right. Right.
There's a thing about Obama, and sometimes I find it annoying, I have to admit, which is that he manages to kind of keep his hands very clean and stay very clear of a lot of the crap that other people are getting kind of mired in and putting out statements that commit them. I think of, for example, the war in Georgia in August, which is something that I think we had wanted to talk about a little bit too, but I think of that war in Georgia, and you know, I was no fan of McCain's sort of wacky, headless chicken, belligerent, you know.
So you didn't feel you were a Georgian too?
Well, my father lives in Tbilisi, so in a certain way, I'm a Georgian, but more than you are, and more than McCain is. I'll say that. Although I guess his Randy Shinneman was on their payroll, so that maybe makes him one too. But no, I, you know, that was a little bit nutty. On the other hand, you know, Obama's kind of way of dealing with that, and I guess he was a little bit in maybe some circles, but I don't think universally kind of hit a little bit for his reaction, which was sort of swerving, but he just, you know, he's a sort of master of the vague statement and the kind of, that doesn't
right, if you already like him, you can assume that, or he, right. Whatever he says, you can assume that he's on your side.
But he manages, you know, I think, and he, you know, right now he can, I hesitate to say hide behind, because that sounds like he has like a bad motive or he's a coward, but you know, this line, which I have to say I'm getting so tired of, I understand the purpose of it, but we have only one president at a time.
Right.
And, you know, so every kind of thing that explodes and every piece of doo-doo that hits the fan, he says, well, you know, I'm very concerned, but we have only one president at a time. And that's the kind of, he manages to sort of float.
Right.
Well, a lot of this stuff.
This, I mean, you know, I think he's, you know, he's used that line a lot. And I think as successfully as he can in reference to the Gaza crisis, right? The Gaza crisis would be one, you know, especially, you know, given the construction of his coalition, even though sort of the Democratic elite is very, very pro-Israel, I think Democratic voters more generally are a little bit more divided. And so it does represent just a, you know, sort of a political problem for him. And he's used sort of that line, I think, very, that line has been very helpful.
It seems to be helpful when the one president there is at a time becomes him.
yeah, exactly. I wonder though, I mean, I don't, sort of off the top of my head, and we're talking about pretty profound technological change, but I don't you know, and I guess 2000 is a really bad situation because Bush really wasn't positive that he was going to be president-elect until mid-December. But is it common for president-elects to be as active as Obama has? I mean, I'm thinking here of the weekly YouTube events or the weekly YouTube addresses. And of course, you know, his transition has moved very, very quickly in terms of, although I guess they need a new commerce secretary now.
Yeah. Where did that come from?
Yeah, right. I mean, that kind of surprised me. I just saw on the news and saw, whoa, Bill Richardson's out. And so, you know, I don't know whether that makes the fact that his transition has moved at a very fast rate and seemed very professional, and that he has had a very public presence in it in terms of the YouTube addresses, in terms of laying out very clearly what he thinks legislation should be, and sort of pushing for that in the very short order. And I wonder if that makes the statements on foreign policy seem just a little bit more disingenuous, or if there really is sort of a difference here. There really is a difference between the president's role in foreign policy and the president's role in all of these other things, such that it really would be more detrimental if Obama attempted to step up in terms of, you know, making different foreign policy statements right now. I really don't know. Or if there's just really nothing different that he would have done than the Bush administration up to this point, in terms of, you know, what's going on in Gaza, what's going on with piracy and Mumbai and everything else. And maybe that's just the case, that there isn't a profound difference between what his positions would have been and what the Bush administration's positions actually are.
Yeah, well, that was certainly, I did a dialogue a few weeks ago with Matt Connetti on here, and he was very, very pleased that to determine that there was going to be very little to zero difference in Obama's foreign policy with Bush's, which is certainly not exactly true, I don't think, but you know, his hands are tied by a lot of the same vines, I think.
Right. I mean, the international system remains the international system, and the United States does not have full freedom of action. But I really don't buy the neocon line on that. I mean, they've sort of made a very concerted effort to argue that he won't be any different than foreign policy. And I think that's wrong. I mean, I think we'll see big differences on Cuba policy. We'll see big differences in some other places, too, pretty quickly. Whether we'll see differences in Israel policy is, I think, an entirely different question. But
yeah, and it's also, I think it's a little bit silly to say, you know, so he's retaining Gates, but Gates is not the person who really defined the Bush presidency's military strategy and approach in Iraq. That was Rumsfeld, right? Bush, Gates was sort of an import towards the end, a kind of a Band-Aid. I think it's more of an unknown. It's one of these unknowns about him, how his foreign policy will really manifest itself, and how, you know, for example, I was just reading today some about Russia, and that's been a little bit on the news back burner just in the last few days because of what's happening in Gaza, but they are, Putin and Medvedev and so forth are trying to kind of assert themselves, and you know, there's this idea that maybe they'll test Obama, or some of this Ukraine gas embargo stuff is kind of feeling their oats or whatever. And it's just really, I don't know, it's so hard to know. There is a fascination in Russia, as there is all over the world, with Obama, but I don't know if it's the same thing as respect, this intrigue with him, or whether they'll, you know, to what degree they'll see America differently because it's headed by Barack Obama. I was just spending New Year's with a friend who covers Russian politics from Moscow, and you know, there's a lot of problems with immigration and also race in Russia. So race problems there, not dissimilar to the kind that we've had in this country at times. And you know, so there's these two. He says there's these two kind of impulses there. One is, wow, you know, they got rid of Bush. That is, you know, that's amazing. Obama's going to be so different. He's a global president. He's the president of the world instead of just America, et cetera. He's not neo-imperialist or neocon, whatever that means now. And then the other is, and I'm not sugarcoating this, is like, wow, that makes us, that really verifies our impression of silly Americans that they elected a black guy as president.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. Russia hasn't exactly done, didn't exactly do badly during the Bush years. There were some aspects of what you might call the neo-imperialist foreign policy, of the, especially missile defense, which Russia
they
really
didn't
like.
They didn't do badly, you mean they didn't make out badly, or?
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, Russia had, I think, substantial economic growth, until the last year, in which nobody said economic growth. They did extremely well from the general refocus on fossil fuels. And they're still doing, well, they're not doing so well because of the collapse in price of oil, but they did very, very well from the high prices of oil as well as anybody. It's sort of interesting to me that the
is
Russian
any of
view,
their success due to Bush's soulmate connection with Putin, that they had this soul level kind of bond?
Who knows, right? What did McCain say, that he looked in his eyes and saw KGB?
The letters KG and B, and yeah, he said that at every freaking rally. I don't
know. But like China, I think that the last 8 years have been relatively successful in terms of Russian foreign policy and in terms of Russia's domestic construction, or the Russian state's domestic construction of how it wants Russia to look like. And so, you know, if I were Russian, maybe I would look fondly back at the Bush years. Certainly more fondly back at the Bush years than the Clinton years, when if sort of everything went to hell. And so that's really curious. You know, it's interesting you mentioned the testing thing, too, because I was kind of surprised that Medvedev took such an aggressive stance on putting the missiles next to Poland right out of the gate, right after the election. Hmm. It really surprised me because it didn't seem to make sense. I mean, it seemed to me to look like an effort at intimidation of the United States, right? We're going to intimidate you into not deploying this missile defense system. But with somebody like Obama, who's already pretty sketchy on missile defense, and I think rightly sketchy on missile defense, to make it look like then he was backing down if he withdrew the missile defense offer from Poland, it seemed to me it made it harder to remove the missile defense system when Medvedev was making those very aggressive statements and the very aggressive actions in early November.
It reminded me that there was an old Soviet slogan, which was American encirclement, and that was a loose translation, and that was always a fear, you know, when there were troops stationed in Germany and Italy and kind of on all these borders. And I think that's still a kind of the sense of American encirclement, with American kind of, I don't know, you could say meddling or involvement in Georgia, right, and strong American involvement, although behind the scenes and oblique, in, say, the Orange Revolution in Ukraine and in that country, and then the missile defense, and, you know, I think that it's a really old impulse to sort of really lash out strongly against that kind of thing.
I get that, but the timing was curious to me.
Yeah.
Anyway, I mean, you said you were recently in Tbilisi, so what is post-war, speaking of Georgia, what is post-war Georgia? What's the gestalt of post-war Georgia?
The gestalt. Well, it's hard to say. I mean, it was the first time I've ever been in Tbilisi. I was there in November, and and it's an amazing country. I would encourage you to go there. It's not really a hot tourist destination, but it's so easy to go. And Tbilisi is absolutely beautiful. And you can go up so easily, just up into the Caucasus Mountains, even up to the border of Chechnya, and up the main road up to the border of North Ossetia, although you can't get into South Ossetia right now, I don't think. But, there are barely signs that there was a war. You know, there's a neighborhood in Tbilisi called Vake, which is kind of reminds me of parts of Paris or St. Petersburg, or, you know, it has the Louis Vuitton stores and the cafes and the Segafredo Tbilisi. And, you know, it has a sort of prosperous look in some ways, but it was striking too, the sort of grim attitude. There seemed to be a belief, and my father's a professor there at a university, and we went out with his students and also fellow teachers and other people in business or whatever, and there was like the universal and strong belief that they will eventually, and not too far from now, be again under Russian direct control, that like their country is going to disappear, which, you know, I guess seems sort of unlikely to me, but you know, they hate Saakashvili. He was much more loved by McCain than by any right. actual real Georgians.
Right.
On the other hand, they also hate Putin. I mean, it was striking here, and I would hope, you know, I would hope that the advent of Obama, who's in some way somewhat untinged by some of this stuff, is sort of Bush-era squabbling, can sweep this away. But how much the reaction to that war here, stateside, kind of fell into this easy mode of debate and argumentation that was shaped by the Iraq War. So on the one hand, you have like McCain running around, we're all Georgians, we must free them, this tiny country under an evil oppressor, whatever, right? Where America is supposed to be on the side of democracy. And then, on the other hand, sort of like, oh, anyone who sides with Georgia is a neocon, and the desire to help them is sort of neoconservatism, and the kind of mistakes that we made in the run-up to the Iraq War. I think of The Nation magazine, which I sometimes like, but they were to some degree like a sort of example of this. And they had a guy who published more than one kind of angry article about
Ames, right?
Yeah, Ames. Mark Ames is a fascinating character. He ran a magazine which has been shut down that was like totally raunchy and raw, and it was about prostitutes in Moscow, like just tons of prostitutes, and he wrote actually some stuff which about the kind of degradation of sex there in the 90s, and that I remember being interesting. But he then got on this bent for The Nation, which I thought was sort of, it just was as silly as the McCain response, and so colored by our own experience in the Iraq War of, oh, so the New York Times took this neocon line where they wanted to see Georgia as the poor democratic victim and villain, vilify the Kremlin, which, you know, and it's actually evil Georgia. And, but then you got over there and it's sort of like, there's a lot more in common between Georgia and Russia. It's like two people in high school who really hate each other because they're too much alike, and they see what they don't like in each other. I mean,
right. Well, I mean, I think that, and you probably know, and certainly your dad knows more about this, but I mean, Georgians, ethnic Georgians were high within the Russian imperial hierarchy, and they were high within the Soviet Union in terms of, you know, being bureaucrats and so forth.
Oh,
and so the cultural connections were very tight.
Well,
you know, it's interesting. What's that?
Stalin.
Oh yes,
born
including
in Glory,
including
the biggest one at all.
And I believe Beria was also from Georgia.
I didn't know that.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned this because I was called out by name in the New Republic, no less, for being insufficiently. I think I wrote something like, "It's hard to tell who's at fault right now." David Greenberg actually published something, and people like Robert Farley, who writes at the American Prospect, say it's too hard to tell what's going on right now. And I was called out for being insufficiently pro-freedom.
Really?
I'm still bitter about that, and I've in fact challenged him to a blogging heads on that very issue, and he has thus far rejected my challenge.
Insufficiently,
or actually not
pro-freedom.
Responded.
You're like those
Basically.
Guys who protested the freedom fries in the House cafeteria.
Right, right.
That
I mean,
basic.
Yeah. Right, and I mean, he waxed very poetic, right? As tiny Georgia is crushed by monster Russia, American liberals can view this only through the lens of Bush's imperialism, and so therefore Russia or Georgia must be evil to them. And I found that irritating. And I still do, because I think the more we know about it, the more complicated the situation becomes between Georgia and Russia.
Yeah, and part of that, I think, is, you know, there were journalists over there who, there's kind of a desire, I mean, I don't mean this to sound sort of sick, but like the desire for a story about genocide or a kind of black and white story with a character who's a villain and one who's a kind of David and Goliath hero, which could be Saakashvili, but if you were over there, you knew that was a little bit ridiculous. And I think it's come out since that both sides massively exaggerated their claims. Like the Russians initially said, you know, 2,000 killed in Tsinkvali, or something like that. And they maintained this in the face of evidence for a long time. And then they just recently did an official report saying, well, okay, final number is 169, which is like,
right.
That is a difference
less than
of
2000,
magnitude,
right.
Order of magnitude. Yeah. But then, you know, and the New York Times was the paper that later, you know, several months after the fact, but did do some strong reporting on this saying basically the tapes and the evidence now show that, this was Saakashvili's sort of attempt at heroic romantic incursion in the first place, but then it was not unprovoked earlier,
right.
And it is very kind of gray, and right. I hope that, you know, that's one of my hopes, I guess, for Obama's presidency, is that we can leave some of the lenses that I think, you know, both somebody like David Greenberg, but also Mark Ames, The Nation, are using in terms of kind of seeing people as divided into these two camps, and the ones were those who either were pro-freedom / Bush imperialists, and then the other is appeasers / you know, heroic kind of believers in diplomacy and anti-interventionists, or, you know, that's too simplistic, but I think there is this like framework, and it's tiring to kind of play these roles, you know?
Right. Going a little bit back, it is sort of fascinating to me because, you know, I think, you know,
I'm sorry, by the way, for your slander in my rag.
Huh? Well, you know, I mean, I haven't seen a correction printed. You know. It is sort of fascinating, you know, when we talk about sort of mirror imaging, Saakashvili and Putin, that the, what the Georgians did do extremely successfully, and pretty much the only successful aspect of their war effort, was they mastered that narrative, right? They mastered that lens that you just talked about, in that they seemed almost perfectly to understand American politics, in sort of in their sense in the rhetoric they used, it seemed very well prepared.
That's right.
And Saakashvili knew exactly, you know, he spoke good English, right? All the people on TV spoke good English. They knew just exactly how to make the claims that would spur sympathy. And they
had
just
a
masterful.
There was a kind of iconic photo of him. And in retrospect, it makes him look small and ridiculous. But he was like in a crowd and he was ducking because there was gunfire or there was a cluster bomb or, you know, that's
right,
the
claim. Right.
That was like the first, one of the first photos of that war. And it was kind of like, you know, the embattled small people that placed their faith in America and had their soldiers trained by America, and now America's going to abandon them because of our bad experience in Iraq, and isn't that, you know, terrible of us, et cetera. I think that's right. I think that's a good point.
Right. And, yeah, it was fascinating to me. And I wonder, like, so if they thought very consciously about that or if they just sort of lucked into it or what exactly. But, I mean, they did very well in that sense. So.
He does, I think if I think of the, you know, Moscow press corps, a few of whom I know, you know, their impression of Saakashvili has turned into a sort of comical one, like this strutting comical. So maybe that's his strategy, which I think is extremely West-oriented. You know, he went to Columbia. He does have this this strong desire to kind of form the narrative of his little country and himself as the kind of founder of it in the Western press. He there's a hilarious piece in Slate, which you should read if you haven't. It was a total don't miss about this travel writer. It was published during the Georgia War, I think, as a kind of peg. But this travel writer, like a totally kind of no-name stringer travel writer who was in Georgia, and somebody realized she was in Georgia, and Misha, as they call him, like phoned her personally and invited her to come jet skiing with him. And then she found themselves drinking cha-cha, which is the Georgian aquavit, and dumplings. And, you know, Misha was regaling her, and she was a little bit stunned, like, what the hell is going on here? You know, why is he giving me this attention? But it is this effort of his. But I think of, and you sent this article to me, actually, and it was totally fascinating. It was published just a few days ago, but by Ellen Berry, who's great, in the Times. And it was like a you know, it was catching up with Misha in Georgia, basically. And, you know, it does reveal how totally, incredibly U.S. directed his whole line of thinking was. I mean, he says, and he seems very kind of strutting and sort of like a man who had these grandiose, you know, Henry V or kind of nation founding, ambitions. And, you know, what he's actually been able to do is smaller than that. But he said that initially he had wanted to model himself after David the Builder, who you hear about a lot, actually, when you go to Georgia. It's a kind of, it's a romantic society there. There's every dinner that you go to has people really sing. They bring, like, guitars to restaurants. There's a whole toast ritual where people toast the motherland quite, and they use that word quite, like, unironically. But and David the Builder was, I think, 13th century, around then, kind of the founder of the medieval kingdom of Georgia, which was very flourishing civilization. Sure. And in this article, I would love to know what you thought of this article, but it had Misha saying, you know, I've scaled back my ambitions. I no longer want to be David the Builder. And, you know, written about, sung about in troubadours songs for generations to come. Right? Now I just merely want to be George Washington now. George Washington, while he was a glorious founder and a mighty general, and he did not want to be king, and he gave up power peacefully, and he realized the limitations of himself as opposed to David the Builder, who was a sort of, I don't know, proto emperor, you know. So, my ambitions are reduced, but it was totally, you know, it was just something made to be printed.
Well, I mean,
for
when you're choosing between near mythical lawgivers, right? I mean, that's the sort of the fascinating, the fascinating comparison there. So, you know, it's going to remain interesting, right? And you know, I just recently read about a little bit about this new strategic relationship agreement between the U.S. and Georgia and what exactly it means. One thing that's kind of interesting to me about it is, sort of, you know, I'm very interested in conversations about military doctrine and strategic doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
And the Russia-Georgia war is sort of proving a very interesting narrative within the strategic community, right? It's actually a narrative that's being used to argue against multilateralism. Because it's, what did this 1,000-ship Navy get us? What did this NATO thing get us here? We weren't even able to stop Russia from invading Georgia. And this is where multilateralism leads us. You know, and it's a fundamentally dishonest narrative because, of course, we could have tried to intervene in the war. It would have been absurd and ridiculous and incredibly destructive, but NATO didn't exactly stop us from doing so. But it is being used as a narrative, about sort of the renewal of threats and how multilateralism fundamentally can't be an answer to those threats.
Do you have any sense? I mean, and I should probably wrap up soon, but Obama's particular advisors, so the people who are, I guess, people like Rice or Steinberg or Jim Jones or whatever. I mean, Have any of them weighed in on this? Do you have any kind of general impressions of the lessons that they took from Russia, Georgia, or that they're kind of taking from it now, if any?
You know, I really don't. Mm-hmm. And that's a really good question, and I don't know exactly sort of where they're going. But anyway, we were going to talk a little bit about the Senate situations, which we can still do in like 4 minutes.
Yes. Senate situation, totally crazy. Mm-hmm. It's hard to know. I feel like Harry Reid is being completely mau-mau'd right now. You know, the Republicans, and I used to be a defender of Reid, and I still, you know, I like him personally to the extent that I've ever interacted with him, which is minimal. I love his press secretary. I think that guy, Jim Manley, has a lot of impact on how Reid is covered because he's so helpful and so nice, which maybe is a bad thing from a media point of view. But he just somehow seems to open himself to this, like, consistently to this kind of Republican mau-mauing. You know, now they're saying, well, you have to seat Roland Burris because Harry Reid is a racist. Did you hear this line?
I heard the line of argument. I haven't heard the Republicans especially making it, but.
Yeah, it's in totally bad faith. You know, it's just ridiculous, but.
Right, and then he came out against, or apparently he lobbied Blagojevich into not picking Jesse Jackson Jr. for some reason.
No Jesse Jackson Jr., no Emil Jones, and no, Davis or Daniels. Danny Davis. And those three are, black Illinois politicians. So now it becomes Harry Reid thinks blacks are unelectable, even in the age of Obama. So he doesn't, you know, and, I don't even know what to make of it. It's such a freaking mess. And I almost feel like, I mean, doesn't Roland Burris kind of have to be seated?
Yeah, the legal arguments appear to be incredibly complex and beyond me. so I really haven't the faintest about whether they have to seat him or not. I do wonder whether in the future, I guess I wonder two things. One, are more states going to move to a special election system rather than a gubernatorial appointment system? And I actually talked to some politicos from Kentucky about that yesterday. And you know, maybe there's no difference between Kentucky or Illinois on this point, but they said that in Kentucky, exactly the same thing would have happened regarding the Blagojevich, except that no one would have cared, because that's simply how things are done in Kentucky. So,
right.
I guess maybe the answer is then that governors won't give it up because it is such a golden thing, is having this ability to name senators. I wonder, though, in the future, if presidents are going to become a little bit more sketchy about nominating senators to cabinet positions, right? I mean, they already don't nominate when they fear they'll lose the seat, but just sort of this, the Illinois disaster and the, you know, the ongoing Illinois or New York saga.
New York drama, right.
Whether, you know, a future president or even the current president when the second administration rolls around or when he needs a commerce secretary, for example, will say I'm not going to bother with all the trouble that this involves of appointing a sitting senator because it just seems to be a disaster every time. Although I guess Colorado handled it okay, although I've heard some criticism. But I guess, you know, Delaware, too, there was criticism there, although that was a vice president rather than a cabinet, so.
Well, it has. I mean, there's something about these senatorial appointments that it, and I don't have a strong memory for past, whether there's been kind of meltdowns like this in the past. Appointments can always be controversial. You know, if somebody had an illegal immigrant as a nanny or something like that, but, it shows this kind of seamy underbelly of, you know, these ways in which our system is not that democratic, right? In New York, you have someone who believes, I think, to some extent, and her cadre believes that she's entitled to this seat to some degree dynastically, although I'm sure she also strongly believes that she deserves it, and that she's worth it, and that she'd do a good job, which I honestly doubt. And then in Illinois, you have this thing just being put up on the open market. And I do believe that, you know, I maintained that the greatest error that Blagojevich made was not to, you know, attempt to shake down Jesse Jr. or whatever, but was to use so much profanity. Because, you know,
it makes the soundbite so much more interesting.
It
right?
did. It made it much seem so much dirtier and more like Nixonian and so much more salacious and tabloid fodder and great for the New York Post headlines and all that kind of stuff. Whereas I think, you know, it was just a little bit more shameless of a version of something that happens all over the country in all kinds of appointment situations like this, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Effing valuable thing, and I doubt other people in his position would have given it away for absolutely nothing. You know, maybe they would have held out for a slightly more honorable, like, policy promise.
Right. No, that would have made it more noble, right? If give me more highway funds for Illinois or something like that, rather than more stroke election funds and a job for my wife. The Blagojevich is just cinematic, though. I mean, that's part of the thing, the hair and just his way of speaking, and that makes the whole scandal just fun. And I guess that's sort of the worst thing for a scandal to be for a particular politician,
fun.
If it's fun. Right?
Right.
The Lewinsky thing was fun. Right, it was all fun.
Spitzer was fun because of the socks, you know, and
right.
his little, it's all in the details. It's like
right.
a director would have great, you know, these little juicy shots that you can do of
right.
of Blagojevich with his Paul Mitchell, black Paul Mitchell hairbrush and how mm-hmm. he called it the nuclear football and couldn't go anywhere without it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right, right, exactly.
It's not kind of boring. I think you're right.
Right.
Well, this has been great. Maybe just to wrap up, I wonder, this is a... It's kind of an abstract question, but so we talked about, you know, the leadership models and who Misha Saakashvili, you know, that he had this dream of modeling himself after David the Builder, and now it's scaled back to George Washington. If you had do you have any, like, say you had a dream model for who you hoped Obama would most model himself after?
In terms of one of these sort of quasi-mythical,
maybe it doesn't have to be so kind of self-aggrandizingly mythical as George Washington.
But they all are
right.
Right. I mean, that's the whole point, right? It's not just Lincoln; it's the myth of Lincoln. Someone who, you know, this is interesting, and I probably had some thoughts on this that I don't recollect right now exactly.
I would just say, maybe it's unfair. I've been thinking about this a little bit earlier today
uh-huh.
and kind of pouring it over, so I sprung it on you cruelly. Uh-huh. But
what are your thoughts? Maybe.
Well,
your thoughts
I mean, you know, he loves Lincoln. I think he tries to model mm-hmm. himself after Lincoln. I think that's great to a lot of degrees. I mean, if I were him, I guess Lincoln was a great lover of Shakespeare. Obama, I don't know. I would read. This is going to seem sort of esoteric, but I would read Henry IV, both of those plays, and then Henry V, because just in terms of the kind of problems about setting tone and maintaining his image that he may encounter, when I think of a kind of political figure that his life path has been similar to, it's by no means a perfect analogy, but you think of Prince Hal in Shakespeare,
right.
and you know,
the
whole appeal
is it
of him
Jeremiah
was that,
Wright or?
Was that he came from, yeah, he hung out with seedy types who weren't in the mainstream kind of proper society. That was Falstaff for Prince Hal, obviously, and you know, the kind of appeal that he had was that he consciously built his life around a trajectory, which is he'd been a rogue, and this is to some degree, I mean, this is a certain theme of dreams of my father. Not, you know, I don't think Obama was ever as kind of totally off the rails as Prince Hal was, but built, you know, he's kind of a rogue, and he had no experience. He hadn't done that much in his life. And, then, you know, he kind of came from not really having those expectations to making this amazing oration and doing this and killing Hotspur, who was kind of the young, ambitious, perfect Hillary of his time. Again, this analogy is not perfect at all, but, and this was his main accomplishment. It is really only accomplishment. And then he became king with these huge, you know, he was just a mythical figure already, I think, because of the kind of meteoric rise from being a do-nothing sort of random person into this slayer of dragons. And anyway, if I were him, I would read Henry V and see kind of how.
You know, it's interesting because when you're talking about that.
Obviously, the guy's fictional.
right. Henry V wasn't that fictional, but.
Well. Shakespearean representation.
Well, I mean, here's the thing, though. I mean, because I've thought about, you know, the parallel between a particular American figure and Prince Hal has occurred to me before, but it was George W. Bush, right? That really struck me as a sort of a failed, but that struck me as actually quite similar in some ways to the Prince Hal of the Henry IV plays. And I think in self-image is very much the King Henry V. I think he envisions himself giving the St. Crispin's Day speech and so forth. And so it seems to me that George Bush, in a sense, fit very well into that mold. I know, it's kind of interesting.
Much more than Kerry or Gore. I mean, these two men both have these kind of titanic narratives to their lives, you know? And great, great cinematic material. I mean, both Bush and Obama. And, there's something not totally dissimilar about their rise, but obviously the tone, Obama's so serious and Bush is like eternally playful, even at totally inappropriate moments. So that will be completely different. I hope. One can only hope. Blank slate. Tabula rasa. That's my dream. But it was great to talk to you.
Yeah, no, it's a fun conversation. I mean, we had hoped, Blogging Heads, listeners and watchers who have probably stopped listening by now, we had hoped to be much more aggressive in terms of disagreement. I think we failed in that, actually.
I think we did fail. Well.
Which is actually, I think I'm, because I'm too agreeable of a guy, I think people regularly complain about that in the comment sections of these, so.
Oh, really? I don't look at my comments. It would probably be a bloodbath, so.
Yeah, it's kind of.
That should be
your
new
tag. Kind of depressing, so.
Well, next time in Jerusalem and with more, anger and disagreements.
But
interesting to talk to you and hope you're looking forward to the end of this interregnum as much as I am. And, until next time.
Right. Yes, exactly.
Great.
Been a lot of fun.